Again, scarf wearing, espresso sipping, Kafka citing, philosophizing about the game and its beauty. You're listening to the third episode of the As We Podcast. The As We Podcast, where we deliver a desperately needed dose of football analysis. Or maybe we just pretend to be extremely smart. My name is Konstantin Eckner, editor for Spielverlagerung, and at my side are again two educated students of the game. First, I would like to welcome our Scotland and Russia correspondent, Alex Lawrence.
Thank you very much for having me.
And the third guy is, once again, Judah Davis, who's our regular contributor on this show. Judah, how's it going?
Yeah, great, as always.
All right, we decided to dedicate this episode to your questions and ask you to send us everything you want to be discussed with a specific focus on theoretical aspects of the game. So let's not waste any time and start right away. First question comes from Jamie Hamilton at Sterling on Twitter. He writes, should football theory be considered as objective or subjective? So who wants to take the question?
I think, well, it's an interesting question. I think the objective subjective divide fits, you know, more neatly with, you know, like science and then like social aspects like philosophy or something like that. In terms of football theory, I don't think it fits neatly into either one of those because there's always like a level of subjectivity from the writer. So we're human beings. We can't like fully remove ourselves from what we're writing. So there's levels of subjectivity there, sometimes even inaccuracy. But of course, there are some things which are clear and very different, such as like the characteristics between different strategies, for example, like the characteristics of man marking versus zone marking. So those things are really clear, whereas there are some things which are more gray or less black and white. So it's a mix of both, I'd say.
I would agree with that. Just as Judah mentioned, there's built into football and especially built into viewing and writing and talking about football, there is a great deal of subjectivity just because we are looking at the game through our own lens. We're looking at the game and the way that we see the game, the things that we pick up on are shaped by what we deem to be important and what we like and what we don't like. So there's already this inherent subjectivity built into the game, which makes it difficult to sort of, again, just as Judah said, it makes it difficult to sort of separate yourself completely from the analysis process. Also consider that the game of football is so fluid and there's so many things interacting and overlapping with each other at any one time that it can be difficult to objectively assess where one thing stops and where another thing begins. So if you're looking at something, for example, say different types of coverage in zonal or man-oriented defending, it can be difficult to objectively determine where a player's reference points flip or where a player's reference points change or even what they are or what order they occur in, just because there are so many things interacting with each other, which makes it really difficult to get an objective perspective when watching and analyzing.
All right. Next question is from Darian Wilken at Coach Darian on Twitter. He says, could you elaborate on different types of pitch maps and how it is used in regards to juego de posición? For example, Guardiola, Tuchel, or Pochettino? I don't know. Judah, I think you're an expert. Maybe.
Well, yeah, we'll see.
Certainly not me.
Well, in terms of, you know, how they're used, obviously, like, I think what Darien means is how they divide their training field to give the players an orientation in terms of how to position themselves in their in the matches. So that's what they're used for, really, is to give a clear reference point in terms of where the players need to position themselves with regards to where the ball is, where the teammates are, and to an extent, where the opponents are as well. For example, and a clear example is like when the ball is on the wing, you've got the half space marked out, which sort of they give an explicit indication about who needs to be in the half space to offer that option back inside. And it's also like given a deep option to go backwards, but also an option to go forwards from there as well. So yeah, that's basically the use of those training field dividers, really. I don't really have many details in terms of how, you know, Tuchel or Pochettino divide their training field, but some coaches, I think, would divide their training field but be a bit less explicit. So I think Guardiola is an example of someone who's probably quite explicit in terms of the positions that need to be occupied, who needs to be there, and when they need to be there as well. But I think if someone like Klopp is using a similar, you know, training field division, then I think he's probably less explicit with who needs to be where. They have, like, his Liverpool team at the moment clearly have a lot of freedom to occupy different spaces on the field, but at the same time, there are some constants in their structure, such as given that depth and the width, whether it's from the fullbacks or whether it's from the forwards. So there's key spaces that need to be occupied. Also, like, the midfielders need to occupy certain positions to give clean circulation. But I think he puts less emphasis on who occupies these positions as opposed to the fact that they need to be occupied. Of course, they need to be occupied to him, but he puts less emphasis on exactly who needs to occupy it. So it's a bit less fluid in his method, it seems.
All right. And also, I think Tuchel has talked about how he has used several kinds of pitches. Sometimes, especially in his Mainz days, where he used like small but lengthy pitches. Then he used like diamonds so that the players were first to play towards the touchline and then back to the middle.
Yeah.
So that's maybe one example as far as Tuchel goes. And yeah, Guardiola, I think you can look it up on Google. There are some like Google Maps, type of, pictures of his, pitches he has used, at Bayern Munich, for instance. So yeah, there's some material online.
If I could just jump in on just what Judah was saying there. So obviously Judah's there talking about, guys like Guardiola using these pitches as tools for an explicit coaching, using the markings as a reference point. So even like, I mean, this goes all the way back to guys like Arrigo Sacchi using cones or such like that to mark out. I think there's a video that came out recently of Sampaoli with Universidad de Chile when he's coaching pressing movements, and he's using reference points in the forms of mannequins. So whereas that's quite explicit, Constantine mentioned there, there's also a lot of scope for using pitches like as an implicit tool. So just the one that you mentioned there with Tuchel using the diamond-shaped pitches to promote diagonality. So by cutting the corners, you're discouraging vertical play down the flanks. And if you're discouraging vertical play down the flank, so where else can you go? You go diagonally towards the centre. So these are implicitly promoted behaviours. So, I mean, the overarching idea here, if you're using pitches like that, or if you're using rules for zone occupation, is that you're letting the environment provide the basis for learning, rather than the learning coming from the coach saying, you have to be here, you have to be there. The learning is coming constantly. It's not, the learning isn't coming just when the coach decides he wants to say something. The learning is coming all the time. So you're getting a much more implicit and an organic approach. And obviously there's a lot of literature to support the fact that these are beneficial in the coaching process.
Yeah, absolutely. So the next question is from Loris at @der_hemi on Twitter. He writes, what will be the next tactical revolution after Catenaccio, Ruego de Posición, counterpressing, etc.? Are there any possible revolutions left? Alex, your take?
This is an interesting question. Obviously, it's impossible to predict what's going to come next. It's difficult enough to tell what's going to happen in the next 5 minutes, let alone the next half or the next game or the next month, next year, whatever. What we can do, though, is we can look at certain trends and we can extrapolate to see where they go, and we can sort of start to make deductions as to what that means for the state of the game. Rennie had a particularly interesting Twitter thread during the summer where he talked about what he saw as being the next sort of big thing, or one of the next characteristics of the modern game. And the point that he made is actually one that is a really interesting one. Since the 70s or since the 60s, 70s, there's been great increases in fitness, with teams, players being much more adequately physically prepared. We have players running 14, 15 kilometers a game, able to cover a lot of distance for a lot of time, able to make more sprints, all this type of stuff, more actions, more consistent actions, better actions, if Verheyen wants to have his say as well. So from a defensive perspective, that means that if players are able to cover more distance, that means that, well, since the pitch is still the same size, it means that you need less players to cover certain amounts of distance. So the one that Rennie alluded to was, indirectly, he suggested that what will come next is there'll be defensive formations with more lines. So, for example, what Roger Schmidt's doing at Leverkusen, what he did at Salzburg, where they play with a 4-2-2-2. So by having more lines, you're making it more difficult to progress vertically. But since the players are immaculately physically prepared, they are actually able to still cover the width of the pitch. So as basically what Rennie is saying is that as players get more fit, that they will be able to cover the same distance with less players. And so that instead of having lots of players focusing on preventing the ball going from side to side, like as is the case in maybe a 4-4-2, you're able to expend more personnel, more energy, more resources into preventing play going vertically, which obviously in a game like football, which is a goal-oriented invasion sport, is key, and certainly will probably change the... It'll force a lot of interesting reactions in the years to come.
Yeah. Judah, any idea?
No, it's like Alex said, it's a tough one to predict. Like you said, the idea of having more lines becoming a bit more regular is very possible. And like you said, the reaction that would create from teams in possession is something that's interesting to look at. So obviously, like you said, it makes it tougher to progress vertically. So you have to look then a bit more horizontally or diagonally. And obviously, at the end of the day, the goal is to move towards the opposition goal. So the way that teams would build connections in order to move diagonally and then to then make progressions forwards is something that could be quite interesting to look at.
Yeah, right. And I mean, speaking of tactical revolutions, it's not, they always come like organically. It's not like someone somewhere comes up with a new idea. And then it's kind of a revolution. It's more like it's growing from various developments in football, and so like especially like counter pressing. It's not like someone invented counter pressing a few years ago. Yeah. It was more like it was always there. Maybe not as defined, but still it was there. The same with Juego de Posición. I mean, with very possession based positional play.
If you look at the examples given, I mean, Catenaccio, Juego de Posición, and oh, sorry, butchered that, and counter pressing, these are all consequences of the game of football rather than a change in the way it's played. So, I mean, given that in football you can do so many things, it's only a matter of time until someone would come up with something like Juego de Posición. And in fact, already, I mean, you look at it, I mean, a lot of the tenets of, let's just call it JDP for now, but my Scottish accent is just butchering all of Johan Cruyff's legacy here. Mm-hmm. If you look at a lot of the tenets of it, a lot of the tenets are what I think something that a lot of guys on Twitter seem to get up in arms about. A lot of the tenets seem to be in common sense stuff in terms of if you want to play with a domination over the ball, stuff like spacing, stuff like that is a consequence of wanting to, well, of playing football. So it's only a matter of time until someone came up with that. Same as counter-pressing as well. I mean, like you said, it's not like someone decided, okay, today we're going to press a counter-attack, we're going to counter-press. I mean, I'm sure back in even the 1870s, there were instances of a team losing possession and then someone player instantly wanting to win the ball back or another player going to help him. So, I mean, these are the games of football taken to the extreme, pushed to the limit, as opposed to a complete revolution in how it's played. So I think we'll probably end up seeing that as well.
Right. The next question is from, or next statement is from Stefano Zudias. He writes, talking about how the panelists create a strategic model for a team would be interesting. Well, Judah, you want to take the question?
Yeah.
Or I think, it's not really a question, but yeah.
Yeah. Rene wrote an article about how to create a game model, I think about a year ago or something like that. And obviously that's an excellent piece to read. And it gives obviously a lot of aspects for what a coach to consider. Some of the most important aspects are assessing the qualities of the players that you have already, and trying to see what kind of style would fit the players that you have. And if they don't, what you do in reaction to that. Also, considering things like the style of the league is also very important. So it's like considering what is, for example, a league-wide weakness. So is there a certain aspect of the game that several teams in the league struggle to handle or to deal with. So a good example recently, this is probably an underrated aspect of Leicester's title win, is how Ranieri based his system on a weakness of the Premier League. And I don't know if this was done intentionally, but it was done. And it's that inability of several Premier League teams to defend the counter-attack. So by basing Leicester's game model heavily on the counter-attack, he's been able to exploit a large weakness in the league, and it's no surprise that they took the league by storm with several teams struggling to handle their counterattacks. So that's one aspect that really needs to be considered, what the league is like. Are there any specific weaknesses or strengths? How do you go about avoiding that? Also, the coaches coming into a new team, we have like a choice. You could either sort of come in with a certain idea of how you want to play and the certain player profiles that you need to play that system. That's one option. And if you don't have those player profiles, then you go out and buy them to sort of put it together. But another approach, and personally, I would like to do this myself, which is to come in and assess what you have already, and to try and create a system based on the qualities the players have already.
Just one thing, I think a lot of coaches are forced to do the second thing, because they come in mid-season, you know, without the option to buy new players, and they have to deal with what they have in the squad. Or even like youth coaches, you know, they can't buy new players.
Absolutely.
So I mean, there are things like a lab situation where you have a concept and a system, and then you buy your players, but who really can buy all the players he needs? So
yeah, that's true. But yeah, like I said, so when you sort of choose to, and like, this is my preferred choice, if I'm choosing to base my system heavily on what we have already and to try and use a system that fits the players that are already there, the aim then is to harness that understanding that the players currently have between each other, since they've been playing together before. If you can harness the understanding they have without having to change too much, and to have a system whereby players complement each other, and it leads to a system whereby all the players complement that system really well, then you have a very good chance of creating a cohesive game model.
All right. Alex, anything to add?
Well, yeah, the points that Jed is making there about the different sort of phases that go on when you either join a new team or when you decide you want to take on a new direction, especially this analysis phase where you have to evaluate what you already have, is obviously so, so, so important. And also that decision that you make, and do you try to morph them to you, or do you try to morph them to you, or do you morph to them? So we've seen that obviously with, we've seen that with Antonio Conte most significantly in the Premier League this season. And I'm pretty sure something happened, a similar situation happened with Juventus, is that correct? Where he wanted to play a certain way, and was ended up being forced into playing with his 3-5-2. Is that correct?
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So, in that sense, it's obviously it's quite a dynamic process, and you might find that one at some point it might be best to try to morph them to your style, and then at a certain point, they might reach a point where you can then morph to them, or vice versa. In terms of the actual about how you would actually go about doing that from the coaching side, now again, I'm not hugely qualified to talk about it, but again, Judah mentioned about looking for or examining league-wide trends. Okay, and they used the example of Leicester. Obviously, in their the way that Ranieri set them up to take advantage of the poor control of the counter-attack and across the league. So with the team that I'm currently working at in the country that we play in, there is a prevailing thought that defending means man-marking. And so therefore a lot of the work that we do goes around playing against man marking, how to manipulate opponents, how to open up spaces, how to play into these spaces and then advance from there. So in that sense, that's kind of the approach that I've gone down. Again, in terms of the actual coaching, for the fundamental things, for stuff that happens, you know, all over the pitch, sort of regardless of position, stuff like moving out from behind cover shadows, using the ball to move the opponent and then playing through them. For these types of things, I tend to do this stuff implicitly, because this is the stuff that has to be really strong. This is the type of stuff that has to really be, that the player has to be comfortable with doing. It can't be something that's forced onto them. It has to come from the player themselves. Has to come from an understanding of what they're doing. More explicit coaching. So a style where myself or my co-coach might talk about specifically what to do in certain situations and how to make certain movements. These will mostly occur in specific phases of the game or specific areas. But for the fundamental stuff, the stuff that happens all over the pitch, it's predominantly implicit.
All right. Next one comes from Alex Cram at Cram_football. He writes, speed in game, player speed, ball speed, how it is important. Well, how important is it, maybe? I don't know. Juna, you again?
Yeah, I think I'd pick up on ball speed just to start with. That's obviously pretty key in terms of when you're playing with possession. It's not to say that you have to play with speed, but it's very useful. It's pretty common to hear, you know, pundits, etc., commentators say, yeah, you know, you need to move the ball quicker and all that kind of thing. But I think one thing that isn't often realized is that is a means to an end. And that end is obviously to disorganize the opponent and then to create those advantages you need to go and create a goal scoring opportunity. And with the ball being such a big reference point for defenders, it's moving the ball quickly and moving the point of attack, which poses that challenge to their reference and to their orientation. And when you do that really quickly, it really challenges them to reorganize their field of view and body position and things like this, which sort of leaves them vulnerable to runners, and it leaves them, it increases the chances that they fail to track a runner, they miss him, he goes on their blind side or something like that. So doing that is really important in terms of actually creating a free man and creating someone who you can actually play to in a dangerous position. So yeah, player speed is, you know, can be divided into a few different categories. Probably most notably physical speed and speed of thought. I'd say these are, you know, important. They could be important characteristics or parts of a system. So if I know I have a really fast striker, like Aubameyang, for example, I might choose to play on the counterattack. And it could be, of course, a vital component of my system in that sense. So it's quite obvious in terms of transition-based game, or in terms of using their speed in terms of pressing. But the speed of thought is also could also be very vital in these situations. So in a counter-attacking situation, the decision-making is often more clear, with like probably less options, less defenders as well. So the decision-making is usually quicker because the counter-attack happens quicker than like a settled possession where you build into the third. So speed of thought in that sense is also very important there. Speed of thought in terms of moving into passing lanes to intercept the ball could also be very important in terms of pressing or counter-pressing phase of the game. And also in like settled possession where you're building from the back or slowly building up the game to create an attack, the speed of thought in terms of creating connections, moving out of opponents' cover shadows, and generally trying to enhance the ball circulation can be a very vital aspect there. So yeah, these could be very important characteristics of a system.
All right, Alex?
Just before I start, I would like to advise you, Constantine, that you get a good clip of Judah's impersonation of what might be a Martin Keown, possibly a Jermaine Genus at the start of that. I thought it was a fantastic impersonation of an English pundit there, Judah. I'd like to congratulate you on that one. As for the question, again, yeah, you come at this from different approaches. So with player speed and ball speed, so again, when we have, say if our team's in possession, then if the opponents are defending primarily against our players as opposed to defending zonally, so if they're defending man marking or in any sort of system, which prioritizes defending against the direct opponent initially. Then player speeds, obviously, if the player can move quickly or quickly adjust his positioning or quickly move into another area, then he's going to get an advantage somehow. Just because, again, the reference point with which the defender is referring to is moving. And moving creates complexity, creates a need for decision, it creates a need for a reaction. And none of these things, if any of these things are not done adequately well enough, then you're going to have a free player. That's a pretty straightforward one. With the ball speed, again, it's the same idea though. It's the same idea. With the ball speed, the primary, maybe not the primary, but certainly high up on the reference list, I say, is the ball. So again, if the defenders are focusing on the position of the ball and how they are controlling the position of the ball through their positioning in a zonal system, if you're changing the position of that reference point, then they're going to have to adjust. And the quicker you make them adjust, and the more often you make them adjust, and the more pressure you put them on, the more pressure you put them under to adjust correctly and accurately, will make it much more difficult for the defenders to deal with. So again, if you have, for example, you have stuff like cover shadows, and cover shadows are great. Covering an opposing player in your cover shadows are a really effective way of defending against him, but it only works if the ball is in that position, or if the ball is along that line between its current position and where the target player currently is. As soon as you move the ball to another angle, that cover shadow is meaningless, and all of a sudden you have an open lane. So using that fast ball speed to get round cover shadows is a really effective way of progressing. And if that ball speed is faster than the opposing team can readjust or compensate for it, then, well, you're going to give them a really, really hard time. Same as ball-oriented blocks as well. Teams that are really horizontally compact, if you can race them to the other side, if you can race them against the ball to the other side of the pitch, to the open side, to the ball far side, then you're going to have success in progressing. So again, really coming at this from two different perspectives, depending on how the opponent are set up. You could also include the speed of transition. If your players are able to transition faster than the opponents, and obviously for a split second, half a second, a quarter of a second, a minuscule amount of time, you're going to be able to effectively play against no opposition. Which might, that such a period of time might sound a bit trivial, but remember that in half a second, I could run away, or rather, Judah could run away from me. I'm not running away from Judah at all. I'm not moving very quickly. Judah could run away from me. He could get to top speed, not quite top speed, but he could get moving, and he could be 3-4 yards away from me, which we all know in football can be a very significant distance. So, yeah, all these different things, speed is so important.
The next one is from David Goygitzer, @David_Goygitzer on Twitter. He asks, why does Judah have such a strange accent? Alex?
Well, I could comment, but I feel it's more fitting if I pass this one, across to Judah. So Judah, just an echo. Just why do you have such a strange accent? What makes it so strange?
Yeah, well, you know, there's a saying, don't throw bricks from glass houses. And I think knowing David and how he speaks, I think that's probably good advice for him. Nah.
We're getting personal in the podcast today.
Yeah, right.
Yes. Yeah.
Nah, I'm just joking. It's all up. Listen. My accent is my accent, you know. I think I can always change the accent if you like me to change the accent. So this is not a problem.
Martin Keogh now leaving Halal. I mean, this is...
yeah.
Oh my. Oh
I
my.
Do a Jurgen Klopp impression. That's okay. This is the thing that, you know, we cannot control. So okay, it's like this. It's like this. Ooh.
The Impressions podcast.
Yeah, right. Which is not a new run. Just
yeah.
All right.
Don't okay. quit your day job, Jada.
Just some banter from David. No problem.
Hashtag banter.
Huh?
Hashtag banter.
Right.
It's just banter.
Right. So the next serious one is from Goals Ain't Royal at Goals Ain't Royal. Are players in actuality much more similar in quality than we like to think? And is it coaching that makes a difference? In relation to this, how do you assess Tuchel's quote, today's game is a player's game? So, I mean, we should maybe tackle the first one. I don't know, Alex, if you have a take.
Yeah, sure. So if you look at the distribution of quality of players, obviously at the top level, you're going to have players who exceed the level of quality at which they're currently playing at. So the league, in general, the quality of the league will be below. Well, by definition, it will be below the level of these top players. So these top players have free roam almost. Free reign at the top level. So, for example, the obvious example, in fact, it's kind of too obvious an example, Lionel Messi. If you have a team with Lionel Messi, it is much better to have a team with Lionel Messi than it is to have a team without Lionel Messi. So, that's a bit of a truism. Whereas, as we go lower down the pyramid, you'll find that their players are much more easily fitted into quote-unquote levels. So, for example, just around the idea that a player will be able to find their level more often than not. Maybe as you go further down the pyramid, so at championship level, say in England, at championship level, you will still have players who are Premier League players who will be better than the players at the bottom of the championship. But as we go further and further down, that dilutes until... at the lower end of the pyramids, players are generally all pretty much around the same level. They will have different characteristics, they will have different strengths and weaknesses, but if we were to do a FIFA-style adding up of all the ratings and taking an average, you'll find that they'd probably be the same. Obviously, that is not how we assess the talent, but in general, the quality is relatively the same. Certainly, the club, my local team, play in League 2 of Scotland, so in the 4th tier, and in the 4th, they play in League 1, they got promoted last year, they play in the 3rd tier, and in the 3rd tier, and the 4th tier especially, when I noticed it, most of the teams are around about the same quality. So if all the teams are the same quality, if the teams are roughly the same quality, then what makes a difference? Well, as we know, the football as a sport in nature is a synergistic sport, in that the value of the team and the impact of the team is far greater than the sum of its parts. So the interactions between players sort of increase the quality of the team. So if you just take the players on their own, great, but the interactions between the players are what make the team successful or not, good or not. Again, using Leicester again as an example, we saw that the level of interactions between the players, their level of understanding of what each other was doing, these interactions and this, again, to use Verheyen, this communication between the players was at a very high level, which meant that even though the players were not, the players were a good level, but they weren't at that sort of outlier level at the very top, the interactions between the players made a huge, huge difference.
All right. Judah, do you want maybe to answer the second one? So like the Tuchel quote where he says that today's game is a player's game. Do you agree? Disagree?
Well... It's a hard question to answer.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it takes a little bit away from like this thinking that the coach, like Tuchel or Guardiola, or that these coaches are so influential. Tuchel basically says that like he has some influence because he's the coach. He, you know, he leads every exercise during the week and everything, and he decides what tactics his team plays. But at the end, his players are the guys who have to execute the plan. And also, I recently spoke to a professional coach who is coaching a first division team. And he said that, you know, the best tactics is when your play, or 90% of tactics is when your player is just great. So, decision making and of course, technical ability and everything, plays a huge role. So I think that's like what Tuchel wants to say here.
Yeah, I think, it's common for coaches like Tuchel and, you know, Guardiola, another example, to sort of understate their influence. So obviously, an example is like Pep coming in this year at Man City and like Sterling's upturn in form. He says, of course, you know, he says, yeah, no, it doesn't have anything to do with him, but that it's Sterling working harder at his game and, you know, really taking responsibility for his game and making an improvement himself. But obviously, that's understating his influence because Pep's come in, he's improved the team and he's improved like the situations that they get Sterling into. So they can utilize his, qualitative superiority, in situations that really suits him as a player. So, you know, in isolation situations out on the flanks against certain fullbacks where he can really excel. So I think yes and no. Obviously, coaches are hugely influential. The way they set their team up, we spend a lot of time analysing tactics and strategies, coaching methodology, and we don't do it for no reason. These are hugely important aspects of the game. We've seen coaches, for example, Tata Martino, with all the talent he had at Barcelona, incredible talents like Messi, Neymar, Busquets, Iniesta. He even had Xavi back then as well. And he didn't quite make a system stronger than the sum of its parts. Whereas, you know, we've seen other coaches who have been able to make great or really good teams from a system, from a pool of players who weren't quite at the level. So you can make a system, you know, greater than the sum of its parts, in other words. So, yeah. Essentially, I'd say, well, you know, yes and no. You need the buy-in from the players, but again, that's also about how the players receive you and also how you put your message across. So it's half and half, I think. It's, as one of my friends say often, it's a symbiosis. So it's a combination of different factors. And obviously, some of those factors are the players and some of those factors are from the coach.
Okay, we are back after a short break. So the next question is from Nikhil Nair at Nikhil Nair 93. He asks, please discuss attacking in the final third with examples of top clubs, as in how do they go about their attacking? Judah, your take.
Yeah, so of course, as he's pointed out there, there's, you know, loads of different ways of approaching final third attacking. I think final third attacking becomes sometimes really unclean from an analytical point of view, in terms of literally what's happening and writing it down and really rationalizing the process sometimes can be quite difficult because, again, it's just really unclean sometimes as teams just do whatever they can to try and get the ball in the box and try and get a dangerous situation. But there are some teams who are really free-form and they just try to overwhelm the opponents with constant movement and, you know, try to use that to create a gap to play through and then they can try and create something dangerous. Liverpool's probably a good example of that at the moment with their front three, Mane, Coutinho, Firmino, and also even like Lallana and their midfielders and the fullbacks given width. There is a lot of variation in terms of the way they set up. Klopp was on MNF not too long ago, Monday Night Football, that is. And he spoke about, not caring too much about who is where, but just that these positions are occupied. So I think I referred to that quite earlier. So it's like giving a lot of freedom to the players to sort of pop up in different spaces and then try and overwhelm the opponents eventually with a lot of movement. Whereas some teams are a bit more structured, you know, preferring to often create the same patterns. So it's like often quite rehearsed sometimes. For example, Man City under Pep at the moment, they use a lot of, preset movements to sort of constantly attack in a similar way. So whether that's Zabaleta making late movements infield to sort of open up the space for Sterling to have an isolation and then to really attack the fullback before trying to get the ball in the box, or whether that's David Silva moving diagonally towards the flank to sort of allow Nolito to come inside and then try and combine that way before reaching the byline. And then, yeah, of course, there are some teams who focus on just crossing the ball. I think most Premier League teams would probably come under that category. But yeah, we're talking about top teams. So Man United, let's just say, Man United are a good example of a team who pretty much tried to overwhelm the opponents with crossing. And of course, you know, they have some real aerial threats with the likes of Ibrahimovic, Pogba, Fellaini when he plays. So yeah, in some sense, I guess it makes sense trying to utilize their aerial advantage in that way.
Next one is from Sports Data Challenge at Sports Data Chill with one L. Would you ever consider playing with three wingers at the same time with two doubling up against a fullback? That's kind of interesting. Alex, maybe you would like to answer it.
Yeah, this is an interesting idea. Really, it depends what the strengths of the wingers are. Usually, wingers are noted for 1v1 ability, maybe even 1v2 in exceptional cases. But primarily, if they are these players that do like playing in isolation, then why would you want to complicate things? Why would you want to bring in someone who could potentially bring with him another defender, or potentially kill the space for him to move into, or just get in the way otherwise? Also, if you then do that, then you're ceding the chance to play someone else in the middle of the pitch. So then how do you compensate for that? So really, you could. And depending on the game situation, there might be a situation in the game where, here, you know what, I'm going to play with two wingers against this fullback, or two wingers against this fullback and this wide midfielder is tucking in, or whatever. But at the crux of it, if you want your wingers to be, or if you know that they are fantastic at 1v1, then let them play 1v1. I think it was Cruyff who said that, you know, you think that you're helping by moving towards them, but actually you're not. You're just complicating things. Move away. Again, it does depend on the situation. It's a very boring answer. But in general, if you have these 1v1 players, let them play 1v1 and use that other extra player better elsewhere.
The next one is from Korsik, maybe, at Korsik at underscore Vasa. I would love to know more about the movements required to bring about good staggering in a structure. Judah?
This is, really completely dependent on the situation. And by that, I mean, obviously, the position of the ball, the position of your teammates, and, of course, the position of the opponents. But there are some general sort of guidelines, or like a rule of thumb, if you like. And you often hear people talking about trying to create triangulation or diamond-like structures. And these are advocated in some sense because they give adequate spacing and a strong connection. Well, not, let me not say strong connection, but it gives as many connections as possible in terms of the use of the number of players. So a diamond-like structure, for example, the player at the base of the diamond would have a vertical option and two diagonally outward options. But what that gives is the option to progress vertically, diagonally, but also giving those players the backwards pass to allow for safe circulation. That's also, you know, in terms of if you lose the ball, that player's there behind the ball to sort of try and win it back. But also in terms of, okay, if we can't make progress that way, pass it back and then we can go out another way. So it's about moving into situations whereby you create a strong connection with your players and also a safe connection for safe circulation, really.
Next question comes from Masroor at Masroor Husnain at Twitter. I'm sorry if I pronounced some names wrong. It's kind of hard to figure out where all the people come from. So, yeah. He asks, teams like City, Arsenal and Liverpool are very fluid when they don't have a traditional striker up front. Would you recommend teams to drop a striker if they have good midfielders and attacking midfielders and wingers who can score a lot? I don't know. Alex, maybe you want to answer it?
It's something that we're seeing more and more of in the game these days. I'm trying to think. I think Dortmund tonight, spoilers. Dortmund tonight played with Royce up front. I didn't get a chance to see the game, but just from judging from the team sheet, it looks as though they had Royce up front, who isn't noted for being an out-and-out striker. As with many things, it does depend on the situation. Although more and more often we're now seeing that teams are eschewing the striker and instead preferring these midfielders and attacking fielders, wingers, who are more flexible, who are capable of being more flexible, capable of playing in other roles and then in other positions, being much more dynamic in their positioning rather than being this, you know, what we would consider to be an old-fashioned number nine, just a lump that stands up front. And you just play around him. With these, if we start getting to the stage where we do sort of neglect this type of player and go for more dynamic and more flexible, more versatile players in that role, then obviously there is some strategic benefit to occupying that space, but then you're then saying, just like what Jada was saying with Liverpool, it's not really a matter who's occupying it, who is performing that role, just as long as somebody is, which obviously gives a lot of benefits in its own way. Now, at the end of the day, the aim of the game is to put the ball in the net. So if you have a player who is very good at doing that, then sure, go for it. But there's certainly an argument to be had that you can make it easier to put the ball in the net, and therefore you can have players with a lesser ability to do so. You can make it easier for them through the dynamic occupation of the number nine position.
I mean, when you look across Europe, is there any top team? Or top team, I mean, a team who could maybe, you know, come to the quarterfinals in the Champions League or maybe winning the cup, stuff like that. Is there any top team that has a traditional striker up front, and I mean, meaning someone who really just waits up front to receive the ball? I mean, I don't really think so.
We wouldn't consider Lewandowski to be.
But I think so. Lewandowski and Bongzema are not really traditional strikers.
Yeah, they're much more dynamic in that sense, much more useful.
I mean, especially Lewandowski in his first season at Dortmund, he often played as a number 10.
Yeah, exactly.
Not really. I mean, even Cavani is not really a traditional striker.
Cavani is probably the closest to that.
Yeah, and Giroud. I mean, he doesn't play that much at the moment, but...
Even Giroud, though. I mean, Giroud is much more than just someone who stands in that position and touches the ball twice and scores a goal. I mean, his His combination play is fantastic. The prime example, I think, just come to mind there, Mauro Icardi. Mauro Icardi, I saw a pass map from him from the Milan derby on Sunday. Mauro Icardi, I think he had four complete passes. Three of them were kickoffs, and one of them was a miscontrolled a pass which he miscontrolled into, I think it was Perisic, which was outstanding.
Okay. Yeah, maybe. Didn't want to say that Giroud is like a traditional striker, but he comes close to maybe, the type of traditional striker. The same with Cavani and maybe Lewandowski, but all of them are rather dynamic and they can switch positions, drift to the outside. So I don't really see the traditional striker at top teams at least anymore. So next question comes from Tiki Tektic. At Tiki Tektic, so with a C at the end. Do you guys like any coach who isn't known for high intensity pressing? Judah.
Well, I mean, before I answer the question, I'm just going to say that it seems like a lot of people have this idea that we advocate dogmatically several types of strategies. For example, if a coach isn't utilizing positional play, then we don't like them. Or if they don't press high, we don't like them. If they don't do this, we don't like them. But it's less than that. We don't have these dogmatic things, ideals, or advocate these things. We just want to see good football.
Speak for yourself.
All they can. So obviously, I am speaking mainly for myself, but it's also friendly. And what I mean by good football isn't 60% possession each game. What I mean is being effective and utilizing the as high a percentage of the player's capabilities as possible, and just generally being cohesive. So, to answer the question, there's a lot of coaches, for example, Favre, at the moment at Nice. He came to my attention reading several articles and watching a few of his games at Gladbach, whereby they are very position-oriented, so it's quite a passive, defensive approach. Marcelino, very much the same at Villarreal. Very is one of my favourite coaches, actually. It's definitely in terms of a defensive point of view. Ancelotti isn't really known for high-intensity pressing, though he's something of a strategic chameleon, if you like, since he's really adapted to the situation and these players and everything. But you wouldn't exactly say he's known for high-intensity pressing. So, yeah, there's several coaches. I can name several more, really. Conte, for example. So. Yeah, loads of coaches.
What about you, Alex?
The one that springs to mind for me is Kurban Berdiev when he was at Rostov last season. Arguably he's still there. I don't think anyone's really quite sure. But his Rostov team last year, for those of you not aware, they pushed CSK Moscow all the way to the final day of the season. They finished second, and if it weren't for Igor Akinfeev making a wonder save on the last day, they would have tied CSK Moscow in points or won the league outright. I can't remember exactly which, but his Rostov team were very, very passive in the initial stages. Not a high pressing team at all. Very passive in how they soaked up pressure and then launched into the space on the counter attack, much like Leicester did. Another example that comes to mind is a team that I really enjoy watching in Mexico, in Tigres, and their coach Ferretti. Although as we were talking earlier that high intensity pressing, high pressing in Central and South America isn't really seen much because there aren't many teams that are compact enough to do high pressing without being absolutely killed. So I think there's different reasons for the lack of a high press. But nonetheless, just as Judah said, we welcome all types. So I've mentioned Berdiev there and Ferretti too. Polar opposite coaches, but at the end of the day, it's
It's what we perceive to be good. And what we perceive to be good isn't dogmatic at all.
And Renato writes a suggestion on how to defend the inside and outside corridors in a 4-3-3 without making your winger and attacking midfielder drop too deep. Who would like to answer it?
I'll take this one. Where am I going? Initially, if you don't want your players to drop too deep, then you're implying that you want to stop the ball progressing there. The easiest way to do that is to make the area in which you're defending smaller. So you start with your striker, a bit of directional pressing, show them towards the flank, show them towards the rest of the team. Then you have some ball-oriented shifting. So a few shuffle motions. Get your fullback engaged in there as well, nice and high, and really try to pin the opposition into that side. So you can be quite aggressive with positioning of your winger and your attacking midfielder, since they only have to cover a couple of passes. And as we mentioned before, along that passing line, you can stand anywhere in that passing line and still give a cover shadow. And if the area is smaller, then it's easier to set that. Get some cover from the pivot as well, just to make sure that that anything that goes over the top is able to be covered, or anything that gets through the first man won't get through the second. And then obviously with your ball oriented shifting, we don't want that ball far winger man marking the opposite fullback. A bit of a pet hate of mine. So yeah, you have those, the ball or ball far winger and the ball far number 8 tucking in and just preventing the ball from escaping there. So really the keys there are to make the area smaller. And then you're creating that overload by sort of, you're effectively cutting out their ball far players. You're making them completely irrelevant. So you're able to activate your ball far players while they aren't. So then with a numerical advantage, it's much easier to defend proactively and with your winger and your attacking fielder nice and high up.
Chuna, anything to add?
No, not really, to be honest. I think he's covered that.
Okay. The next one, Lucas Fesca via Facebook. He asks, what do you think is the reason Tuchel doesn't get an intense pressing going? Anyone?
I haven't seen enough of Dortmund to be able to give an analysis on that aspect.
Watching the Bayern Munich game, you saw that Dortmund are able to play an intense high pressing. Problem this season is they are only capable of doing it for like half an hour, maybe 45 minutes or so. Then they will get really exhausted and have to turn to a more passive strategy and to be more passive. So I think it's to some capacity it's a issue of fitness and stamina this season. I think a lot of exercise, a lot of training. So Tuchel doesn't really focus on conditioning that much. He tries to prevent injuries, so maybe that's the reason. Tactically, I think Tuchel is capable of setting up strategy to let his team do a high press or stuff like that, do intense pressing.
That was going to be a question I was going to ask there. Do you think it's a case that there's not enough energy in the tank for a lot of the players, or do you think that a lot of the energy is misused and used inefficiently or ineffectively? So they're maybe pressing when it isn't appropriate to press, or so on.
I think it's more like their stamina, like their gas tank is not big enough this season. Because you saw it in the Bayern Munich game, and also, when I remember correctly, in the Real Madrid game, where they really have like this drop of energy after 50 minutes, 60 minutes, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
In the Bayern Munich game, they knew that they had to switch or change tactics after like half an hour, because they were really intense during the first phase of the game, but it wasn't possible to like continue or intense pressing all the way down to like the 17th, 18th minute. So they knew they had to change tactics after like 30 minutes and, you know, drop deeper, defend it closer to their own penalty box, which eventually, I mean, paid off. It's something, especially compared to like Klopp's Dortmund, there's really a difference to see. As I mentioned, tactically, Tuchel is, of course, capable of applying many, many different tactics. So the next question comes from EdgeDocs132. His Twitter handle is, however, at AidenPierce442. So he asks, importance of body shape, angle, awareness when receiving a pass and making a pass.
Yeah.
Chuda, you? Yeah.
There's, of course, a lot of talk about reference points in all phases of the game, really. And just a little side note is how obviously this is often influenced by Saki. So if you hear someone saying, reference points of actions on the pitch, you know, it's, yeah, the ball, the opponents, the teammates, and space.
What's that space one, though?
Yeah, we kind of established that space doesn't make sense in that context, because space is just a function of the positions of teammates and opponents. So where there's no teammate, where there's no opponent, that's where there's space. So sort of add space in as a reference point separate to those other aspects doesn't make sense in that context. So that's just a little side note. reference points obviously are very vital in terms of decision making on the pitch. An obvious example is a player receiving the ball and then having an awareness of an opponent and the direction that they're approaching them from behind. So if they know that the opponent's coming towards their right, then it affects what side that they're going to turn out towards. So if he's coming towards my right, I'm going to turn out towards my left, sort of trying to avoid that situation. That's just an obvious example of how these reference points affect decision-making. So knowledge of the game and the game situation around the player is vital. And pretty much every action on the pitch creates a new game situation, which obviously means that this game situation around the player is very, very dynamic. And that's why it's important and vital, in fact, for a player to be constantly scanning the pitch, and to gain an understanding of everything around them and to influence their decision-making, give them as best possible chance to make a good decision. Marcel Lucassen at the DFB, German Football Association, basically, like conceptualized pre-orientation, orientation, and post-orientation. And this is basically to highlight the importance of scanning before, during, and after any action on the pitch.
Alex, anything to add?
Just Judah started to touch on it there. My answer to his question would be perception, and perception. The perception, again, as Judah mentioned, is the precursor to everything. It's the precursor to the decision you make. It's the, and that decision you make then obviously subsequently influences the technical execution that you perform. But without a solid basis in perception, then you're unable to make the optimal decision. So if we just think about body shape, obviously we can gain perception from scanning, just as Judah said. So by turning our, really getting into it here, by turning your neck, turning your head round left or right, or you can gain perception just by facing the object in question already. So, for example, if you take a hypothetical situation where we have a centre-back who is passing the ball vertically to me, so my back is to the opposing goal. So with my body shape, I'm facing my own goal. So what can I see? Well, I can see all that is very interesting about both of my corner flags, which are have a strategic value of about nil in that particular moment. And
even if I turn my head all the way left and then all the way right and give myself a headache in the process, I still can't see the goal behind me. So the most important part of the pitch, I still can't see behind me. So again, the body shape, we can alter that by turning more side on. So already we're starting to get maybe the corner of the goal in our peripheral vision, or by changing the angle, by introducing this diagonal aspect. So again, this is why diagonal passes are so useful. It's because if I receive a diagonal pass, then I'm going to be more likely to be able to see where I want to go. I can see where I've come from, and I can more likely see where I'm going to. So again, when we're receiving the ball, the body shape, the angle influence perception, which is so, so important. So if I can see where I'm going to, I can more likely make the best decision. When making the pass as well, the body shape and the angles available to you are going to influence the perception of the teammates and the opponents around you. So this sort of intrapersonal perception you're giving out, this these signals that you're giving out, this communication that you're giving to the opponents and to your teammates, just through your body shape and your angle. So also when we talk about it in this sense, when we have the ball, when we're making a pass, there is one king, and his name is Sergio Busquets, who is a master at using his body shape and the angles available to him to feign as though he's going to make a pass to the outside, which then the opponents are interpreting that. They're looking at his body shape, his body position, the angles available to him. They're looking at that. They perceive that from Sergio Busquets and from the other players on the pitch. They then react to that perceived threat. And then at that moment, as soon as they've moved, or as soon as they've started to move and have started made a forward momentum, that's when he plays that pass into invariably Lionel Messi. So again, this idea of using your body shape and using the angles available to you is influencing perception, both your perception and perception of your opponents. And of anything that influences perception is very, very important, because perception is it's either at the top or it's one off the top, depending on what model you want to take. It's at the top of the action tree.
The last question comes from @victorolosaurus. He asks, which rule change would you be the most interested in seeing play out on a professional level? So maybe eliminating offside or something. I don't know, Judah, any idea?
Firstly, I'd say this question is really interesting, because like the influence of rules is, I wouldn't say underlooked, because I think everyone has an implicit understanding of how the rules of a game influences behavior on the pitch, and also like tactics and strategies and things like that. But yeah, it's massive in terms of influencing, again, strategies and also, yeah, player behavior and things like that. So yeah, it's an interesting question. One interesting rule change would be looking at how a longer pitch would affect the game. So if there's more depth available, maybe teams would play a bit more vertically oriented. So there'll be perhaps less need for width on the pitch, and teams would sort of position themselves in a way to make quicker vertical gains and quicker progressions. So that would be quite interesting. Also, interesting would be maybe how the defensive teams react to having a longer pitch. Maybe it conditions more of a midfield press with more space in behind to cover. Then maybe teams need to think more about the space behind them rather than aggressive pressing. So maybe it would take a bit away from that side of the game. Maybe teams would have to start with their forwards a bit deeper, and then sort of press the ball once it comes into their own defensive block. So maybe, yeah, that could be an interesting rule change, longer pitch.
Alex?
Just think about what you mentioned there about the change to the offside rule.
I'm sure there was a there was an experiment recently, no, by a, was it a German or a Dutch magazine or newspaper, where they played a lower league match in, I think it was Berlin, where they abolished the offside rule. I haven't come across anything about it since that, so I can't make any comment on how that was, how that played out, but I thought that was quite an interesting rule. Mainly, I think the offside rule is probably the rule that has changed football the most across its history. So we've gone from the period where the offside rule was that there had to be three players between between you and the goal. So then that gave rise to all sorts of very defensive tactics. And then all the various guises that the current rule has gone through. So again, if you watch any videos of Sacchi's Milan, they played literally a different game from what we play now, because they were able to win a free kick just by have just by having everyone run up at the same time. Whereas if you do that now, with the way the offside rule is at the moment, how it's very lenient towards forwards, and with the whole passive and the active clauses added in there, it makes defending inherently different. So you can't do what you used to be able to do, even in the 80s or the 90s. So I think in the past, that has been the most interesting change of rules. If you were to get rid of that altogether, you would end up with something. A case study for this would be field hockey. So field hockey is very similar to football in that there are 11 players, there's a ball, there's a goal at each end. Except in field hockey, there is no offside. So all of a sudden, you have teams that use a huge amount of depth from a very early point in their ball possessions, and this depth means that it inherently gives rise to man marking. So even in even when a team is in a deep build up with the ball circulating around their own D, you will see that the defending team will have one player who's maybe he has access to, but not maybe strictly marking, but he certainly has access to the opposition forward that is invariably lurking on the goal line. So I think to see how that would play in football would be really interesting, because in hockey it is difficult to flick the ball in the air accurately, and there are rules about how high you can play the ball up with your stick, and what's considered to be dangerous play. Whereas in football, we don't have that. In fact, it's really easy to kick the ball in the air. So to see how that would affect the game, and to see if any quote unquote attractive play would still exist after such a real change would be pretty interesting.
Okay, I think that's it for our third episode. Hopefully we will be back in a few weeks, and you can find our episodes on SoundCloud, iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, and of course on our website under spielverlagerung.com/podcast. I would like to say thank you, gentlemen. Thank you to Alex Lawrence. He's at the 10th space on Twitter.
Thank you very much for having me.
And thank you to Judah Davis at 1415 football on Twitter.
Thank you.
And I'm CC_ECKNER on Twitter. So thank you to our listeners for sticking with us. And for now, we are out. Mm-hmm.